Books on Tape presents Throne of Jade by Naomi Novik, read by Simon Vance. Part 1. Chapter 1. The day was unseasonably warm for November, but in some misguided deference to the Chinese embassy, the fire in the Admiralty boardroom had been heaped excessively high, and Lawrence was standing directly before it. He had dressed with especial care in his best uniform, and all throughout the long and unbearable interview, the lining of his thick, bottle-green broadcloth coat had been growing steadily more sodden with sweat. Over the doorway, behind Lord Barham, the official indicator with its compass arrow showed the direction of the wind over the channel. In the north-northeast today, fair for France. Very likely even now some ships of the Channel fleet were standing in to have a look at Napoleon's harbours. His shoulders held at attention, Lawrence fixed his eyes upon the broad metal disc and tried to keep himself distracted with such speculation. He did not trust himself to meet the cold, unfriendly gaze fixed upon him. Barham stopped speaking and coughed again into his fist. The elaborate phrases he had prepared sat not at all in his sailor's mouth, and at the end of every awkward, halting line he stopped and darted a look over at the Chinese with a nervous agitation that approached obsequity. It was not a very creditable performance, but under ordinary circumstances, Lawrence would have felt a degree of sympathy for Barham's position. Some sort of formal message had been anticipated, even perhaps an envoy. But no one had ever imagined that the Emperor of China would send his own brother halfway around the world. Prince Yongxing could, with a word, set their two nations at war, and there was, besides, something inherently awful in his presence. The impervious silence with which he met Barham's every remark, the overwhelming splendour of his dark yellow robes, embroidered thickly with dragons, the slow and relentless tapping of his long, jewel-encrusted fingernail against the arm of his chair. He did not even look at Barham. He only stared directly across the table at Lawrence, grim and thin-lipped. His retinue was so large they filled the boardroom to the corners. A dozen guards, all sweltering and dazed in their quilted armour, and as many servants besides, most with nothing to do. Only attendants of one sort or another, all of them standing along the far wall of the room and trying to stir the air with broad-panelled fans. One man, evidently a translator, stood behind the prince, murmuring when Yongxing lifted a hand, generally after one of Barham's more involved periods. Two other official envoys sat to Yongxing's either side. These men had been presented to Lawrence only perfunctorily, and they had neither of them said a word, though the younger, called Sun Kai, had been watching all the proceedings impassively and following the translator's words with quiet attention. The elder, a big, round-bellied man with a tufted grey beard, had gradually been overcome by the heat. His head had sunk forward onto his chest, mouth half open for air, and his hand was barely even moving his fan towards his face. They were robed in dark blue silk, almost as elaborately as the prince himself, and together they made an imposing facade. Certainly, no such embassy had ever been seen in the West. A far more practised diplomat than Barham might have been pardoned for succumbing to some degree of civility, but Lawrence was scarcely in any mood to be forgiving, though he was nearly more furious with himself at having hoped for anything better. He had come expecting to plead his case, and privately in his heart he had even imagined a reprieve. Instead he had been scolded in terms he would have scrupled to use to a raw lieutenant, and all in front of a foreign prince and his retinue, assembled like a tribunal to hear his crimes. Still he held his tongue as long as he could manage. But when Barham at last came about to saying, with an air of great condescension,
"Naturally, Captain, we have it in mind that you shall be put to another hatchling afterwards,"
Lawrence had reached his limit.
"No, sir," he said, breaking in. "I am sorry, but no. I will not do it. And as for another post, I must beg to be excused."
Sitting beside Barham, Admiral Powis of the Aerial Corps had remained quite silent through the course of the meeting. Now he only shook his head without any appearance of surprise, and folded his hands together over his ample belly. Barham gave him a furious look and said to Lawrence,
"Perhaps I'm not clear, Captain. This is not a request. You have been given your orders. You will carry them out."
"I will be hanged first,"
Lawrence said flatly. past caring that he was speaking in such terms to the First Lord of the Admiralty. The death of his career, if he had still been a naval officer, and it could scarcely do him any good even as an aviator. Yet if they meant to send Temeraire away, back to China, his career as an aviator was finished. He would never accept a position with any other dragon. None other would ever compare, to Lawrence's mind, and he would not subject a hatchling to being second best when there were men in the corps lined up six deep for the chance. Yongxing did not say anything, but his lips tightened. His attendants shifted and murmured amongst themselves in their own language. Lawrence did not think he was imagining the hint of disdain in their tone, directed less at himself than at Barham. And the First Lord evidently shared the impression, his face growing mottled and choleric with the effort of preserving the appearance of calm.
"By God, Lawrence! If you imagine you can stand here in the middle of Whitehall and mutiny, you are wrong. I think perhaps you are forgetting that your first duty is to your country and your king, not to this dragon of yours."
"No, sir, it is you who are forgetting. It was for duty I put Temeraire into harness, sacrificing my naval rank, with no knowledge then that he was any breed truly out of the ordinary, much less a celestial," Lawrence said. "And for duty I took him through a difficult training and into a hard and dangerous service. For duty I have taken him into battle, and asked him to hazard his life and happiness. I will not answer such loyal service with lies and deceit."
"Enough noise, sir," Barham said. "Anyone would think you were being asked to hand over your firstborn. I'm sorry if you have made such a pet of the creature you cannot bear to lose him."
"Temeraire is neither my pet nor my property, sir," Lawrence snapped. "He has served England and the King as much as I have, or you yourself, and now, because he does not choose to go back to China, you stand there and ask me to lie to him. I cannot imagine what claim to honour I should have if I agreed to it. Indeed," he added, unable to restrain himself, "I wonder that you should even have made the proposal. I wonder at it greatly."
"Oh, your soul to the devil, Lawrence,"
Barham said, losing his last veneer of formality. He had been a serving sea officer for years before joining the government, and he was still very little a politician when his temper was up.
"He is a Chinese dragon. It stands to reason he will like China better. In any case, he belongs to them, and there is an end to it. The name of thief is a very unpleasant one, and His Majesty's government does not propose to invite it."
"I know how I am to take that, I suppose." If Lawrence had not already been half broiled, he would have flushed.
"And I utterly reject the accusation, sir. These gentlemen do not deny they had given the egg to France. We seized it from a French man of war. The ship and the egg were condemned as lawful prize out of hand in the Admiralty courts, as you very well know. By no possible understanding does Temeraire belong to them. If they were so anxious about letting a celestial out of their hands, they ought not have given him away in the shell."
Yongxing snorted and broke into their shouting match.
"That is correct," he said.
His English was thickly accented, formal, and slow, but the measured cadences only lent all the more effect to his words.
"From the first, it was folly to let the second-born egg of Lung Tien Chan pass over sea. That no one can now dispute."
It silenced them both, and for a moment no one spoke save the translator, quietly rendering Yongxing's words for the rest of the Chinese. Then Sun Kai unexpectedly said something in their tongue which made Yongxing look around at him sharply. Sun kept his head inclined deferentially and did not look up, but still it was the first suggestion Lawrence had seen that their embassy might perhaps not speak with a single voice. But Yongxing snapped a reply in a tone which did not allow of any further comment, and Sun did not venture to make one. Satisfied that he had quelled his subordinate, Yongxing turned back to them and added,
"Yet, regardless of the evil chance that brought him into your hands, Lung Tien Chiang was meant to go to the French Emperor, not to be made beast of burden for a common soldier."
Lawrence stiffened. "Common soldier" rankled, and for the first time he turned to look directly at the prince, meeting that cold, contemptuous gaze with an equally steady one.
"We are at war with France, sir. If you choose to ally yourself with our enemies, and send them material assistance,
You can hardly complain when we take it in fair fight."
"Nonsense!" Baron broke in at once and loudly. "China is by no means an ally of France, by no means at all. We certainly do not view China as a French ally. You are not here to speak to His Imperial Highness, Lawrence. Control yourself," he added in a savage undertone.
But Yongxing ignored the attempt at interruption.
"And now you make piracy your defence," he said, contemptuous. "We do not concern ourselves with the customs of barbaric nations. How merchants and thieves agree to pillage one another is not of interest to the celestial throne, except when they choose to insult the Emperor, as you have."
"No, Your Highness, no such thing, not in the least,"
Baron said hurriedly, even while he looked pure venom at Lawrence.
"His Majesty and his government have nothing but the deepest affection for the Emperor. No insult would ever willingly be offered, I assure you. If we had only known of the extraordinary nature of the egg, of your objections, this situation would never have arisen."
"Now, however, you are well aware," Yongxing said, "and the insult remains. Long Tianxiang is still in harness, treated little better than a horse, expected to carry burdens and exposed to all the brutalities of war, and all this with a mere captain as his companion. Better had his egg sunk to the bottom of the ocean."
Appalled, Lawrence was glad to see this callousness left Baram and Powis as staring and speechless as himself. Even among Yongxing's own retinue, the translator flinched, shifting uneasily, and for once did not translate the prince's words back into Chinese.
"Sir, I assure you, since we learned of your objections, he has not been under harness at all. Not a stitch of it," Baram said, recovering. "We have been at the greatest of pains to see to Temeraire's, that is, to Lung Tianxiang's comfort, and to make redress for any inadequacy in his treatment. He is no longer assigned to Captain Lawrence, that I can assure you. They have not spoken these last 2 weeks."
The reminder was a bitter one, and Lawrence felt what little remained of his temper fraying away.
"If either of you had any real concern for his comfort, you would consult his feelings, not your own desires," he said, his voice rising,
a voice which had been trained to bellow orders through a gale.
"You complain of having him under harness, and in the same breath ask me to trick him into chains, so you might drag him away against his will. I will not do it. I will never do it, and be damned to you all."
Judging by his expression, Baram would have been glad to have Lawrence himself dragged away in chains, eyes almost bulging, hands flat on the table, on the verge of rising. For the first time, Admiral Powis spoke, breaking in, and forestalled him.
"Enough, Lawrence. Hold your tongue. Baram, nothing further can be served by keeping him. Out, Lawrence. Out at once. You are dismissed."
The long habit of obedience held, Lawrence flung himself out of the room. The intervention likely saved him from an arrest for insubordination, but he went with no sense of gratitude. A thousand things were pent up in his throat, and even as the door swung heavily shut behind him, he turned back. But the marines stationed to either side were gazing at him with thoughtlessly rude interest, as if he were a curiosity exhibited for their entertainment. Under their open, inquisitive looks, he mastered his temper a little and turned away before he could betray himself more thoroughly. Baram's words were swallowed by the heavy wood, but the inarticulate rumble of his still-raised voice followed Lawrence down the corridor. He felt almost drunk with anger, his breath coming in short, abrupt spurts, and his vision obscured, not by tears, not at all by tears, except of rage. The antechamber of the Admiralty was full of sea officers, clerks, political officials, even a green-coated aviator rushing through with dispatches. Lawrence shouldered his way roughly to the doors, his shaking hands thrust deep into his coat pockets to conceal them from view. He struck out into the crashing din of late afternoon London, Whitehall full of working men going home for their suppers, and the bawling of the hackney drivers and chairmen over all crying, "Make a line there!" through the crowds. His feelings were as disordered as his surroundings, and he was navigating the street by instinct. He had to be called 3 times before he recognised his own name. He turned only reluctantly. He had no desire to be forced to return a civil word or gesture from a former colleague. but with a measure of relief he saw it was Captain Rowland, not an ignorant acquaintance. He was surprised to see her, very surprised, for her dragon, Exidium, was a formation leader at the Dover Covert. She could not easily have been spared from her duties, and in any case she could not come to the Admiralty openly, being a female officer, one of those whose existence was made necessary by the insistence of Longwings on female captains. The secret was but barely known outside the ranks of the aviators, and jealously kept against certain public disapproval. Lawrence himself had found it difficult to accept the notion, at first, but he had grown so used to the idea that now Rowland looked very odd to him out of uniform. She had put on skirts and a heavy cloak by way of concealment, neither of which suited her.
"I have been puffing after you for the last 5 minutes," she said, taking his arm as she reached him. "I was wandering about that great cavern of a building, waiting for you to come out, and then you went straight past me in such a ferocious hurry I could scarcely catch you. These clothes are a damned nuisance. I hope you appreciate the trouble I'm taking for you, Lawrence. But never mind," she added, her voice gentling. "I can see from your face that it did not go well. Let us go and have some dinner, and you shall tell me everything."
"Thank you, Jane. I'm glad to see you," he said,
and let her turn him in the direction of her inn, though he did not think he could swallow.
"How do you come to be here, though? Surely there is nothing wrong with Exidium."
"Nothing in the least, unless he has given himself indigestion," she said. "No, but Lily and Captain Harcourt are coming along splendidly, and so Lenton was able to assign them a double patrol and give me a few days of liberty. Exidium took it as an excuse to eat 3 fat cows at once. The wretched, greedy thing. He barely cracked an eyelid when I proposed my leaving him with Sanders, that is my new first lieutenant, and coming to bear you company. So I put together a street-going rig and came up with the courier. Oh, hell, wait a minute, will you?"
She stopped and kicked vigorously, shaking her skirts loose. They were too long and had caught on her heels. He held her by the elbow so she did not topple over, and afterwards they continued on through the London streets at a slower pace. Roland's mannish stride and scarred face drew enough rude stares that Lawrence began to glare at the passers-by who took too long, though she herself paid them no mind. She noticed his behaviour, however, and said,
"You are ferocious out of temper. Do not frighten those poor girls. What did those fellows say to you at the Admiralty?"
"You have heard, I suppose, that an embassy has come from China. They mean to take Temeraire back with them, and government does not care to object. But evidently he will have none of it. Tells them all to go and hang themselves, though they have been at him for weeks now to go,"
Lawrence said. As he spoke, a sharp sensation of pain, like a constriction just under his breastbone, made itself felt. He could picture quite clearly Temeraire kept nearly all alone in the old, worn-down London covert, scarcely used in the last 100 years, with neither Lawrence nor his crew to keep him company, no one to read to him, and of his own kind only a few small courier beasts flying through on dispatch service.
"Of course he will not go," Rowland said. "I cannot believe they imagined they could persuade him to leave you. Surely they ought to know better. I have always heard the Chinese cried up as the very pinnacle of dragon-handlers."
"Their prince has made no secret he thinks very little of me. Likely they expected Temeraire to share much the same opinion and to be pleased to go back," Lawrence said. "In any case, they grow tired of trying to persuade him, so that villain Barham ordered I should lie to him and say we were assigned to Gibraltar, all to get him aboard a transport and out to sea, too far for him to fly back to land before he knew what they were about."
"Oh, infamous!"
Her hand tightened almost painfully on his arm.
"Did Powis have nothing to say to it? I cannot believe he let them suggest such a thing to you. One cannot expect a naval officer to understand these things, but Powis should have explained matters to him."
"I dare say he can do nothing. He is only a serving officer, and Barham is appointed by the ministry,"
Lawrence said.
"Powis at least saved me from putting my neck in a noose. I was too angry to control myself, and he sent me away."
They had reached the Strand. The increase in traffic made conversation difficult, and they had to pay attention to avoid being splashed by the questionable grey slush heaped in the gutters, thrown up onto the pavement by the lumbering carts and hackney wheels. His anger ebbing away, Lawrence was increasingly low in his spirits. From the moment of separation he had consoled himself with the daily expectation that it would soon end. The Chinese would soon see Temeraire did not wish to go, or the Admiralty would give up the attempt to placate them. It had seemed a cruel sentence even so. They had not been parted a full day's time in the months since Temeraire's hatching, and Lawrence had scarcely known what to do with himself, or how to fill the hours. But even the 2 long weeks were nothing to this, the dreadful certainty that he had ruined all his chances. The Chinese would not yield, and the ministry would find some way of getting Temeraire sent off to China in the end. They plainly had no objection to telling him a pack of lies for the purpose. Likely enough, Barham would never consent to his seeing Temeraire now, even for a last farewell. Lawrence had not even allowed himself to consider what his own life might be with Temeraire gone. Another dragon was, of course, an impossibility, and the Navy would not have him back now. He supposed he could take on a ship in the merchant fleet, or a privateer. But he did not think he would have the heart for it, and he had done well enough out of prize money to live on. He could even marry and set up as a country gentleman. But that prospect, once so idyllic in his imagination, now seemed drab and colourless. Worse yet, he could hardly look for sympathy. All his former acquaintance would call it a lucky escape. His family would rejoice, and the world would think nothing of his loss. By any measure, there was something ridiculous in his being so adrift. He had become an aviator quite unwillingly, only from the strongest sense of duty, and less than a year had passed since his change in station, yet already he could hardly consider the possibility. Only another aviator, perhaps indeed only another captain, would truly be able to understand his sentiments, and with Temeraire gone, he would be as severed from their company as aviators themselves were from the rest of the world. The front room at the Crown and Anchor was not quiet, though it was still early for dinner by town standards. The place was not a fashionable establishment, nor even genteel, its custom mostly consisting of countrymen used to a more reasonable hour for their food and drink. It was not the sort of place a respectable woman would have come, nor indeed the kind of place Lawrence himself would have ever voluntarily frequented in earlier days. Roland drew some insolent stares, others only curious, but no one attempted any greater liberty. Lawrence made an imposing figure beside her, with his broad shoulders and his dress sword slung at his hip. Roland led Lawrence up to her rooms, sat him in an ugly armchair, and gave him a glass of wine. He drank deeply, hiding behind the bowl of the glass from her sympathetic look. He was afraid he might easily be unmanned.
"You must be faint with hunger, Lawrence," she said. "That is half the trouble."
She rang for the maid. Shortly a couple of manservants climbed up with a very good sort of plain single-course dinner, a roast fowl with greens and beef, gravy sauce, some small cheesecakes made with jam, calf's feet pie, a dish of red cabbage stewed, and a small biscuit pudding for relish. She had them place all the food on the table at once, rather than going through removes, and sent them away. Lawrence did not think he would eat, but once the food was before him he found he was hungry after all. He had been eating very indifferently, thanks to irregular hours and the low table of his cheap boarding-house, chosen for its proximity to the covert where Temeraire was kept. Now he ate steadily, Roland carrying the conversation nearly alone and distracting him with service gossip and trivialities.
"I was sorry to lose Lloyd, of course. They mean to put him to the angle-wing egg that is hardening at Kinloch Lagan," she said, speaking of her first lieutenant.
"I think I saw it there," Lawrence said,
rousing a little and lifting his head from his plate.
"Of Vasaria's egg?"
"Yes, and we have great hopes of the issue," she said. "Lloyd was over the moon, of course, and I am very happy for him. Still, it is no easy thing to break in a new premier after 5 years, with all the crew and Exidium himself murmuring about how Lloyd used to do things. But Sanders is a good-hearted, dependable fellow. They sent him up from Gibraltar after Granby refused the post."
"What?
Refused it?"
Lawrence cried in great dismay.
Granby was his own first lieutenant.
"Not for my sake, I hope."
"Oh, Lord, you did not know?" Roland said in equal dismay. "Granby spoke to me very pretty, said he was obliged, but he did not choose to shift his position. I was quite sure he had consulted you about the matter. I thought perhaps you had been given some reason to hope."
"No," Lawrence said very low. "He is more likely to end up with no position at all. I am very sorry to hear he should have passed up so good a place."
The refusal could have done Granby no good with the corps. A man who had turned down one offer could not soon expect another, and Lawrence would shortly have no power at all to help him along.
"Well, I am damned sorry to have given you any more cause for concern," Roland said after a moment. "Admiral Lenton has not broken up your crew, you know, for the most part, only gave a few fellows to Berkeley out of desperation, he being so short-handed now. We were also sure that Maximus had reached his final growth. Shortly after you were called here, he began to prove us wrong, and so far he has put on 15 feet in length." She added this last, in an attempt to recover the lighter tone of the conversation, but it was impossible. Lawrence found that his stomach had closed, and he set down his knife and fork, with the plate still half full. Roland drew the curtains. It was already growing dark outside. "Do you care for a concert?"
"I am happy to accompany you," he said, mechanically, and she shook her head.
"No, never mind, I see it will not do. Come to bed, then, my dear fellow. There is no sense in sitting about and moping." They put out the candles and lay down together.
"I have not the least notion what to do," he said quietly. The cover of dark made the confession a little easier. "I called Barham a villain, and I cannot forgive him asking me to lie. Very ungentlemanlike. But he is not a scrub. He would not be at such shifts if he had any other choice."
"It makes me quite ill to hear about him bowing and scraping to this foreign prince." Roland propped herself upon her elbow on the pillows. "I was in Canton Harbour once as a mid, on a transport coming back the long way from India. Those junks of theirs do not look like they could stand a mild shower, much less a gale. They cannot fly their dragons across the ocean without a pause, even if they cared to go to war with us."
"I thought as much myself when I first heard," Lawrence said. "But they do not need to fly across the ocean to end the China trade, and wreck our shipping to India also, if they liked. Besides, they share a border with Russia. It would mean the end of the coalition against Bonaparte if the Tsar was attacked on his eastern borders."
"I do not see the Russians have done us very much good so far in the war, and money is a low, pitiful excuse for behaving like a bounder, in a man or a nation," Roland said. "The state has been short of funds before, and somehow we have scraped by and still blacked Bonaparte's eye for him. In any case, I cannot forgive them for keeping you from Temeraire. Barham still has not let you see him at all, I suppose?"
"No, not for 2 weeks now. There is a decent fellow at the covert who has taken him messages for me, and lets me know that he is eating, but I cannot ask him to let me in. It would be a court-martial for us both. Though, for my own part, I hardly know if I would let it stop me now."
He could scarcely have imagined even saying such a thing a year ago. He did not like to think it now, but honesty put the words into his mouth. Roland did not cry out against it, but then she was an aviator herself. She reached out to stroke his cheek and drew him down to such comfort as might be found in her arms. Lawrence started up in the dark room, sleep broken. Roland was already out of bed. A yawning housemaid was standing in the doorway holding up a candle, the yellow light spilling into the room. She handed Roland a sealed dispatch and stayed there, staring with open, prurient interest at Lawrence. He felt a guilty flush rise in his cheeks and glanced down to be sure he was quite covered beneath the bedclothes. Roland had already cracked the seal. Now she reached out and took the candlestick straight out of the girl's hand. "There's for you. Go along now," she said, giving the maid a shilling. She shut the door in the girl's face without further ceremony. "Lawrence, I must go at once," she said, coming to the bed to light the other candles, speaking very low. "This is word from Dover. A French convoy is making a run for Le Havre, under Dragon Guard. The Channel fleet is going after them, but there is a flamme de gloire present, and the fleet cannot engage without aerial support."
"How many ships in the French convoy, does it say?"
He was already out of the bed and pulling on his breeches. A fire breather was nearly the worst danger a ship could face. Desperately risky, even with a good deal of support from the air. 30 or more, packed, no doubt, to the gills with war material," she said, whipping her hair into a tight braid. "Do you see my coat over there?" Outside the window, the sky was thinning to a paler blue. Soon the candles would be unnecessary. Lawrence found the coat and helped her into it, some part of his thoughts already occupied in calculating the likely strength of the merchant ships, what proportion of the fleet would be detached to go after them, how many might yet slip through to safe harbour. The guns at Le Havre were nasty. If the wind had not shifted since yesterday, they had favourable conditions for their run. 30 ships worth of iron, copper, quicksilver, gunpowder. Bonaparte might no longer be a danger at sea after Trafalgar, but on land he was still master of Europe, and such a haul might easily meet his supply needs for months.
"And just give me that cloak, will you?" Roland asked, breaking into his train of thought.
The voluminous folds concealed her male dress, and she pulled the hood up over her head.
"There, that will do."
"Hold a moment, I'm coming with you,"
Lawrence said, struggling into his own coat.
"I hope I can be some use. If Berkeley is short-handed on Maximus, I can at least pull on a strap or help shove off boarders. Leave the luggage and ring for the maid. We will have them send the rest of your things over to my boarding-house."
They hurried through the streets, still mostly empty. Night-soil men rattling past with their fetid carts, day-labourers beginning on their rounds to look for work, maids in their clinking pattens going to market, and the herds of animals with their lowing breath white in the air. A clammy, bitter fog had descended in the night, like a prickling of ice on the skin. At least the absence of crowds meant Roland did not have to pay much mind to her cloak, and they could go at something approaching a run. The London Covert was situated not far from the Admiralty offices, along the western side of the Thames. Despite the location, so eminently convenient, the buildings immediately around it were shabby, in disrepair, where those lived who could afford nothing farther away from Dragons. Some of the houses even abandoned, except for a few skinny children who peered out suspiciously at the sound of strangers passing. A sludge of liquid refuse ran along the gutters of the streets. As Lawrence and Roland ran, their boots broke the thin skim of ice on top, letting the stench up to follow them. Here the streets were truly empty, but even so as they hurried, a heavy cart sprang almost as if by malicious intent from the fog. Roland hauled Lawrence aside and up onto the pavement just quick enough he was not clipped and dragged under the wheels. The drover never even paused in his careening progress, but vanished around the next corner without apology. Lawrence gazed down at his best-dressed trousers in dismay, spattered black with filth.
"Never mind," Roland said consolingly. "No one will mind in the air, and maybe it will brush off."
This was more optimism than he could muster. But there was certainly no time to do anything about them now, and so they resumed their hurried progress. The covered gates stood out shining against the dingy streets and the equally dingy morning. Ironwork freshly painted black with polished brass locks. Unexpectedly, a pair of young marines in their red uniforms were lounging nearby, muskets leaned against the wall. The gatekeeper on duty touched his hat to Roland as he came to let them in, while the marines squinted at her in some confusion. Her cloak was well back off her shoulders for the moment, revealing both her triple gold bars and her by no means shabby endowment. Lawrence stepped into their line of sight to block their view of her, frowning.
"Thank you, Patson. The Dover courier?"
he said to the gatekeeper, as soon as they had come through.
"Believe he's waiting for you, sir,"
Patson said, jerking his thumb over his shoulder as he pulled the gates to again.
"Just at the first clearing, if you please. Don't you worry about them none,"
he added, scowling at the marines, who looked properly abashed. They were barely more than boys, and Patson was a big man, a former armourer, made only more awful by an eye patch and the seared red skin about it.
"I'll learn them properly, never fret."
"Thank you, Patson, carry on," Roland said, and on they went. "Whatever are those lobsters doing here? Not officers, at least, we may be grateful. I still recall 12 years ago, some army officer found out Captain Saint-Germain when she got wounded at Toulon. He made a wretched to-do over the whole affair, and it nearly got into the papers. Idiotic affair."
There was only a narrow border of trees and buildings around the perimeter of the covert to shield it from the air and noise of the city. They almost at once reached the first clearing, a small space barely large enough for a middling-sized dragon to spread its wings. The courier was indeed waiting. A young Winchester, her purple wings not yet quite darkened to adult colour, but fully harnessed and fidgeting to be off.
"Why, Holland,"
Lawrence said, shaking the captain's hand gladly. It was a great pleasure to see his former ground crew master again, now in an officer's coat.
"Is this your dragon?"
"Yes, sir, indeed it is. This is Elsie,"
Holland said, beaming at him.
"Elsie, this is Captain Lawrence, which I have told you about him. He helped me to you."
The Winchester turned her head around and looked at Lawrence with bright, interested eyes. Not yet 3 months out of the shell, she was still small, even for her breed, but her hide was almost glossy clean, and she looked very well tended indeed.
"So you are Temeraire's captain. Thank you. I like my Holland very much,"
she said, in a light, chirping voice, and gave Holland a nudge with enough affection in it to nearly knock him over.
"I am happy to have been of service, and to make your acquaintance," Lawrence said,
mustering some enthusiasm, although not without an internal pang at the reminder. Temeraire was here, not 500 yards distant, and he could not so much as exchange a greeting with him. He did look, but buildings stood in the line of his sight. No glimpse of black hide was to be seen. Roland asked Hollin, "Is everything ready? We must be off at once."
"Yes, sir, indeed. We're only waiting for the dispatches," Hollin said. 5 minutes, if you should care to stretch your legs before the flight."
The temptation was very strong. Lawrence swallowed hard. But discipline held. Openly refusing a dishonourable order was one thing, sneaking about to disobey a merely unpleasant one, something else. And to do so now might well reflect badly on Hollin and Roland herself.
"I will just step into the barracks here and speak to Jervis," he said instead,
and went to find the man who was overseeing Temrere's care. Jervis was an older man, the better part of both his left limbs lost to a wicked, raking stroke across the side of the dragon on whom he had served as harness master. On recovering, against all reasonable expectations, he had been assigned to the slow duty of the London covert, so rarely used. He had an odd, lopsided appearance with his wooden leg and metal hook on one side, and he had grown a little lazy and contrary with his idleness. But Lawrence had provided him with a willing ear often enough to now find a warm welcome.
"Would you be so kind as to take a word for me?"
Lawrence asked, after he had refused a cup of tea.
"I am going to Dover to see if I can be of use. I should not like Temeraire to fret at my silence." "That I will, and read it to him. He will need it, poor fellow,"
Jervis said, stumping over to fetch his inkwell and pen one-handed. Lawrence turned over a scrap of paper to write the note.
"That fat fellow from the Admiralty came over again not half an hour ago with a full parcel of marines and those fancy Chinamen, and there they are still prating away at the deer. If they don't go soon, I shan't answer for his taking any food today, so I won't. Ugly sea-going bugger. I don't know what he is about, thinking he knows aught about dragons. That is, begging your pardon, sir," Jervis added hastily.
Lawrence found his hand shook over the paper, so he spattered his first few lines and the table. He answered, somehow, meaninglessly, and struggled to continue the note. Words would not come. He stood there, locked in mid-sentence, until suddenly he was nearly thrown off his feet, ink spreading across the floor as the table fell over. Outside, a terrible, shattering noise, like the worst violence of a storm. A full North Sea winter's gale. The pen was still ludicrously in his hand. He dropped it and flung open the door, Jervis stumbling out behind him. The echoes still hung in the air, and Elsie was sitting up on her hind legs, wings half opening and closing in anxiety, while Hollin and Roland tried to reassure her. The few other dragons at the covert had their heads up as well, peering over the trees and hissing in alarm.
"Lawrence!"
Roland called. But he ignored her. He was already halfway down the path, running, his hand unconsciously gone to the hilt of his sword. He came to the clearing and found his way barred by the collapsed ruins of a barracks building and several fallen trees. For 1,000 years before the Romans first tamed the Western dragon breeds, the Chinese had already been masters of the art. They prized beauty and intelligence more than martial prowess, and looked with a little superior disdain at the fire-breathers and acid-spitters valued so highly in the West. Their aerial legions were so numerous they had no need of what they regarded as so much showy flash. But they did not scorn all such unusual gifts, and in the Celestials they had reached the pinnacle of their achievement, the union of all the other graces with a subtle and deadly power which the Chinese called the Divine Wind, the roar with a force greater than cannon fire. Lawrence had seen the devastation the Divine Wind wrought only once before, at the Battle of Dover, where Temeraire had used it against Napoleon's airborne transports to potent effect. But here the poor trees had suffered the impact at point-blank range. They lay like flung matchsticks, trunks burst into flinders. The whole rough structure of the barracks, too, had smashed to the ground. The coarse mortar crumbled away entirely, and the bricks scattered and broken. A hurricane might have caused such wreckage, or an earthquake, and the once poetic name seemed suddenly far more apt. The escort of marines were nearly all of them backed up against the undergrowth surrounding the clearing, faces white and blank with terror. Barham alone of them had stood his ground. The Chinese also had not retreated, but they were one and all prostrated upon the ground in formal genuflection, except for Prince Yongxing himself, who remained unflinching at their head. The wreck of one tremendous oak lay penning them all against the edge of the clearing, dirt still clinging to its roots, and Temeraire stood behind it, one foreleg resting on the trunk and his sinuous length towering over them.
"You will not say such things to me,"
he said, his head lowering towards Barham. His teeth were bared, and the spiked ruff around his head was raised up and trembling with anger.
"I do not believe you for an instant, and I will not hear such lies. Lawrence would never take another dragon. If you have sent him away, I will go after him, and if you have hurt him—"
He began to gather his breath for another roar, his chest belling out like a sail in high wind, and this time the hapless men lay directly in his path.
"Temeraire!"
Lawrence called, scrambling ungracefully over the wreckage, sliding down the heap into the clearing in disregard of the splinters that caught at his clothing and skin.
"Temeraire! I am well! I am here!"
Temeraire's head had whipped around at the first word, and he at once took the 2 paces needed to bring him across the clearing. Lawrence held still, his heart beating very quickly, not at all with fear. The forelegs with their terrible claws landed to either side of him, and the sleek length of Temeraire's body coiled protectively about him, the great scaled sides rising up around him like shining black walls, and the angled head coming to rest by him. He rested his hands on Temeraire's snout, and for a moment laid his cheek against the soft muzzle. Temeraire made a low, wordless murmur of unhappiness.
"Lawrence, Lawrence, do not leave me again."
Lawrence swallowed.
"My dear,"
he said, and stopped. No answer was possible. They stood with their heads together in silence, the rest of the world shut out, but only for a moment.
"Lawrence,"
Roland called from beyond the encircling coils. She sounded out of breath, and her voice was urgent.
"Temeraire, do move aside, there's a good fellow."
Temeraire lifted up his head and reluctantly uncurled himself a little so they could speak. But all the while he kept himself between Lawrence and Barham's party. Roland ducked under Temeraire's foreleg and joined Lawrence.
"You had to go to Temeraire, of course, but it will look very bad to someone who does not understand dragons. For pity's sake, do not let Barham push you into anything further. Answer him as meek as Mother May I. Do anything he tells you."
She shook her head.
"By God, Lawrence, I hate to leave you in such straits, but the dispatches have come, and minutes may make the difference here."
"Of course you cannot stay," he said. "They are likely waiting for you at Dover even now to launch the attack. We will manage, never fear."
"An attack? There is to be a battle?"
Temeraire said, overhearing. He flexed his talons and looked away to the east, as if he might see the formations rising into the air even from here.
"Go at once, and pray take care," Lawrence said hastily to Roland. "Give my apologies to Holin."
She nodded.
"Try and stay easy in your mind. I will speak with Lenten even before we launch. The Corps will not sit still for this. Bad enough to separate you, but now this outrageous pressure, stirring up all the dragons like this, it cannot be allowed to continue, and no one can possibly hold you to blame."
"Do not worry, or wait another instant. The attack is more important," he said very heartily.
Counterfeit, as much as her assurances. They both knew that the situation was black. Lawrence could not for a moment regret having gone to Temeraire's side, but he had openly disobeyed orders. No court-martial could find him innocent. There was Barham himself to lay the charges, and if questioned, Lawrence could hardly deny the act. He did not think they would hang him. This was not a battlefield offence, and the circumstances offered some excuse, but he would certainly have been dismissed the service if he had still been in the navy. There was nothing to be done but face the consequences. He forced a smile. Roland gave his arm a quick squeeze, and she was gone. The Chinese had risen and collected themselves, making a better show of it than the ragged marines who looked ready to bolt at any moment's notice. They altogether were now picking their way over the fallen oak. The younger official, Sun Kai, more deftly scrambled over and, with one of the attendants, offered a hand to the prince to help him down. Yongxing was hampered by his heavy, embroidered gown, leaving trailers of bright silk like gaily coloured cobwebs upon the broken branches, but if he felt any of the same terror writ large on the faces of the British soldiers, he did not show it. He seemed unshaken. Temeraire kept a savage, brooding eye upon them all.
"I am not going to sit here while everyone else goes and fights, no matter what those people want."
Lawrence stroked Temeraire's neck comfortingly.
"Do not let them upset you. Pray stay quite calm, my dear. Losing our tempers will not improve matters."
Temeraire only snorted, and his eye remained fixed and glittering, the ruff still standing upright, with all the points very stiff, in no mood to be soothed. Himself quite ashen, Barham made no haste to approach any closer to Temeraire, but Yong Xing addressed him sharply, repeating demands both urgent and angry, judging by his gestures towards Temeraire. Sun Kai, however, stood apart, and regarded Lawrence and Temeraire more thoughtfully. At last Barham came towards them, scowling, evidently taking refuge from fear in anger. Lawrence had seen it often enough in men on the eve of battle.
"This is the discipline of the corps, I gather,"
Barham began, petty and spiteful, since his life had very likely been saved by the disobedience. He himself seemed to perceive as much. He grew even angrier.
"Well, it will not stand with me, Lawrence, not for an instant. I will see you broken for this. Sergeant, take him under arrest."
The end of the sentence was inaudible. Barham was sinking, growing small, his shouting red mouth flashing open and shut like a gasping fish, the words becoming indistinct as the ground fell away beneath Lawrence's feet. Temeraire's talons were carefully cupped around him, and the great black wings were beating in broad sweeps, up, 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 through the dingy London air, soot dulling Temeraire's hide and speckling Lawrence's hands. Lawrence settled himself in the cupped claws and rode in silence. The damage was done, and Lawrence knew better than to ask Temeraire to return to the ground at once. There was a sense of true violence in the force behind his wing strokes, rage barely checked. They were going very fast. He peered downward in some anxiety as they sped over the city walls. Temeraire was flying without harness or signals, and Lawrence feared the guns might be turned on them, but the guns stayed silent. Temeraire was distinctive, with his hide and wings of unbroken black, save for the deep blue and pearlescent grey markings along the edges, and he had been recognised. Or perhaps their passage was simply too swift for a response. They left the city behind them 15 minutes after leaving the ground, and were soon beyond the range even of the long-barrelled pepper guns. Roads branched away through the countryside beneath them, dusted with snow, the smell of the air already much cleaner. Temeraire paused and hovered for a moment, shook his head free of dust, and sneezed loudly, jouncing Lawrence about a little. But afterwards he flew on at a less frantic pace, and after another minute or two he curled his head down to speak.
"Are you well, Lawrence? You are not uncomfortable?"
He sounded more anxious than the subject deserved. Lawrence patted his foreleg where he could reach it.
"No, I am very well."
"I am very sorry to have snatched you away so,"
Temeraire said, some tension gone at the warmth in Lawrence's voice.
"Pray do not be angry. I could not let that man take you."
"No, I'm not angry," Lawrence said.
Indeed, so far as his heart was concerned, there was only a great, swelling joy to be once again aloft, to feel the living current of power running through Temeraire's body, even if his more rational part knew this state could not last.
"And I do not blame you for going, not in the least. But I am afraid we must turn back now."
"No, I am not taking you back to that man," Temeraire said obstinately.
And Lawrence understood with a sinking feeling that he had run up against Temeraire's protective instincts.
"He lied to me and kept you away, and then he wanted to arrest you. He may count himself lucky I did not squash him."
"My dear, we cannot just run wild," Lawrence said.
"We would be truly beyond the pale if we did such a thing. How do you imagine we would eat, except by theft? And we would be abandoning all our friends."
"I am no more use to them in London, sitting in a covert," Temeraire said with perfect truth,
and left Lawrence at a loss for how to answer him.
"But I do not mean to run wild. Although," a little wistfully, "to be sure, it would be pleasant to do as we liked, and I do not think anyone would miss a few sheep here and there. But not while there is a battle to be fought."
"Oh dear," Lawrence said,
as he squinted towards the sun, and realized their course was southeast, directly for their former covert at Dover.
Temeraire, they cannot let us fight. Lenton will have to order me back, and if I disobey, he will arrest me just as quick as Barham, I assure you.
I do not believe Obvasaria's admiral will arrest you, Temeraire said. She is very nice, and has always spoken to me kindly, even though she is so much older and the flag dragon. Besides, if he tries, Maximus and Lily are there, and they will help me. And if that man from London tries to come and take you away again, I will kill him, he added, with an alarming degree of bloodthirsty eagerness.
Chapter 2. They landed in the Dover covert amid the clamour and bustle of preparation, the harness masters bellowing orders to the ground crews, the clatter of buckles and the deeper metallic ringing of the bombs being handed up in sacks to the bellmen, riflemen loading their weapons, the sharp high-pitched shriek of whetstones grinding away on sword edges. A dozen interested dragons had followed their progress, many calling out greetings to Temeraire as he made his descent. He called back, full of excitement, his spirits rising all the while Lawrence felt his own sinking. Temeraire brought them to earth in Obvasaria's clearing. It was one of the largest in the covert, as befitted her standing as flag dragon, though as an angle wing she was only slightly more than middling in size, and there was easily room for Temeraire to join her. She was rigged out already, her crew boarding. Admiral Lenton himself was standing beside her in full riding gear, only waiting for his officers to be aboard, minutes away from going aloft.
"Well, and what have you done?"
Lenton asked, before Lawrence even managed to unfold himself out of Temeraire's claw.
"Roland spoke to me, but she said she had told you to stay quiet. There is going to be the devil to pay for this."
"Sir, I am very sorry to put you in so untenable a position," Lawrence said awkwardly, trying to think how he could explain Temeraire's refusal to return to London without seeming to make excuses for himself.
"No, it is my fault,"
Temeraire added, ducking his head and trying to look ashamed, without much success. There was too distinct a gleam of satisfaction in his eye.
"I took Lawrence away. That man was going to arrest him."
He sounded plainly smug, and Obvasaria abruptly leaned over and batted him on the side of the head, hard enough to make him wobble even though he was half again her size. He flinched and stared at her with a surprised and wounded expression. She only snorted at him and said, "You are too old to be flying with your eyes closed. Lenton, we are ready, I think."
"Yes,"
Lenton said, squinting up against the sun to examine her harness.
"I have no time to deal with you now, Lawrence. This will have to wait."
"Of course, sir. I beg your pardon," Lawrence said quietly. "Pray do not let us delay you. With your permission we will stay in Temeraire's clearing until you return."
Even cowed by Obvasaria's reproof, Temeraire made a small noise of protest at this.
"No, no, don't speak like a groundling," Lenton said impatiently. "A young male like that will not stay behind when he sees his formation go, not uninjured. The same bloody mistake this fellow Barham and all the others at the Admiralty make every time a new one is shuffled in by government. If we ever manage to get it into their heads that dragons are not brute beasts, they start to imagine that they are just like men and can be put under regular military discipline."
Lawrence opened his mouth to deny that Temeraire would disobey, then shut it again after glancing round. Temeraire was ploughing the ground restlessly with his great talons, his wings partly fanned out, and he would not meet Lawrence's gaze.
"Yes, just so,"
Lenton said dryly, when he saw Lawrence silenced. He sighed, unbending a little, and brushed his sparse grey hair back off his forehead.
"If those Chinamen want him back, it can only make matters worse if he gets himself injured fighting without armour or crew," he said. "Go on and get him ready. We will speak after."
Lawrence could scarcely find words to express his gratitude, but they were unnecessary in any case. Lenton was already turning back to Obvasaria. There was indeed no time to waste. Lawrence waved Temeraire on and ran for their usual clearing on foot, careless of his dignity. A scattered, intensely excited rush of thoughts, all fragmentary. Great relief. Of course Temeraire would never have stayed behind. How wretched they would have looked, jumping into a battle against orders. In a moment they would be aloft, yet nothing had truly changed in their circumstances. This might be the last time. Many of his crewmen were sitting outside in the open, polishing equipment and oiling harness unnecessarily, pretending not to be watching the sky. They were silent and downcast, and at first they only stared when Lawrence came running into the clearing.
"Where is Granby?"
he demanded.
"Full muster, gentlemen. Heavy combat rig at once."
By then Temeraire was overhead and descending, and the rest of the crew came spilling out of the barracks, cheering him. A general stampede towards small arms and gear ensued. That rush, which at once looked like chaos to Lawrence, used as he was to naval order, but which accomplished the tremendous affair of getting a dragon equipped in a frantic hurry. Granby came out of the barracks amid the cavalcade, a tall young officer, dark-haired and lanky, his fair skin, ordinarily burnt and peeling from daily flying, but for once unmarred thanks to the weeks of being grounded. He was an aviator born and bred, as Lawrence was not, and their acquaintance had not been without early friction. Like many other aviators, he had resented so prime a dragon as Temeraire being claimed by a naval officer. But that resentment had not survived a shared action, and Lawrence had never yet regretted taking him on as first lieutenant, despite the wide divergence in their characters. Granby had made an initial attempt out of respect to imitate the formalities which were to Lawrence, raised a gentleman, as natural as breathing, but they had not taken root. Like most aviators, raised from the age of 7, far from polite society, he was by nature given to a sort of easy liberty which looked a great deal like license to a censorious eye.
"Lawrence, it is damn good to see you,"
he said now, coming to seize Lawrence's hand, quite unconscious of any impropriety in addressing his commanding officer so and making no salute. Indeed, he was at the same time trying to hook his sword onto his belt, one-handed.
"Have they changed their minds, then? I hadn't looked for anything like such good sense, but I will be the first to beg their lordship's pardon if they have given up this notion of sending him to China."
For his part, Lawrence had long since accepted that no disrespect was intended. At present he scarcely even noticed the informality. He was too bitterly sorry to disappoint Granby, especially now knowing that he had refused a prime position out of loyalty.
"I'm afraid not, John. But there is no time now to explain. We must get Temeraire aloft at once. Off the usual armaments and leave the bombs. The Navy will not thank us for sinking the ships, and if it becomes really necessary, Temeraire can do more damage roaring away at them."
"Right you are,"
Granby said, and dashed away at once to the other side of the clearing, calling out orders all around. The great leather harness was already being carried out in double-quick time, and Temeraire was doing his best to help matters along, crouching low to the ground to make it easier for the men to adjust the broad weight-bearing straps across his back. The panels of chainmail for his breast and belly were heaved out almost as quickly.
"No ceremony,"
Lawrence said, and so the aerial crew scrambled aboard pell-mell as soon as their positions were clear, disregarding the usual order.
"We are 10 short, I'm sorry to say," Granby said, coming back to his side. "I sent 6 men to Maximus's crew at the Admiral's request. The others..."
He hesitated.
"Yes,"
Lawrence said, sparing him. The men had naturally been unhappy at having no part of the action, and the missing 4 had undoubtedly slipped away to seek better, or at least more thorough, consolation in a bottle or a woman than could be found in busy work. He was pleased it was so few, and he did not mean to come the tyrant over them afterwards. He felt at present he had no moral ground on which to stand.
"We will manage, but if there are any fellows on the ground crew who are handy with pistol or sword and not prone to height sickness, let us get them hooked on if they choose to volunteer."
He himself had already shifted his coat for the long, heavy one of leather used in combat, and was now strapping his carabiner belt over. A low, many-voiced roar began not very far away. Lawrence looked up. The smaller dragons were going aloft, and he recognized Dulcia and the grey-blue Nitidus, the end-wing members of their formation, flying in circles as they waited for the others to rise.
"Lawrence, are you not ready? Do hurry, please. The others are going up,"
Temeraire said, anxiously, craning his head about to look. Above them the middle-weight dragons were coming into view also. Granby swung himself aboard, along with a couple of tall young harness-men, Willoughby and Porter. Lawrence waited until he saw them latched onto the rings of the harness and secure, then said,
"All is ready. Try away."
This was one ritual that could not in safety be set aside. Temeraire rose up onto his hind legs and shook himself, making certain that the harness was secure and all the men properly hooked on.
"Harder!"
Lawrence called sharply. Temeraire was not being particularly vigorous in his anxiety to be away. Temeraire snorted but obeyed, and still nothing pulled loose or fell off.
"All lies well.
"Please come aboard now," he said, thumping to the ground and holding out his foreleg at once. Lawrence stepped into the claw and was rather quickly tossed up to his usual place at the base of Temeraire's neck. He did not mind at all. He was pleased, exhilarated by everything, the deeply satisfying sound as his carabiner rings locked into place, the buttery feel of the oiled, double-stitched leather straps of the harness, and beneath him Temeraire's muscles were already gathering for the leap aloft. Maximus suddenly erupted out of the trees to the north of them, his great red-and-gold body even larger than before, as Roland had reported. He was still the only regal copper stationed at the channel, and he dwarfed every other creature in sight, blotting out an enormous swath of the sun. Temeraire roared joyfully at the sight and leapt up after him, black wings beating a little too quickly with over-excitement.
"Gently," Lawrence called.
Temeraire bobbed his head in acknowledgement, but they still overshot the slower dragon.
"Maximus! Maximus, look! I am back!" Temeraire called out,
circling back down to take his position alongside the big dragon. And they began beating up together to the formation's flying height.
"I took Lawrence away from London,"
he added triumphantly, in what he likely thought a confidential whisper.
"They were trying to arrest him!"
"Did he kill someone?"
Maximus asked with interest in his deep, echoing voice, not at all disapproving.
"I am glad you are back. They have been making me fly in the middle while you were gone, and all the manoeuvres are different," he added.
"No," said Temeraire. "He only came and talked to me when some fat old man said he should not, which does not seem like any reason to me."
"You had better shut up that Jacobin of a dragon of yours!"
Berkeley shouted across from Maximus's back, while Lawrence shook his head in despair, trying to ignore the inquisitive looks from his young ensigns.
"Pray remember we are on business, Temeraire,"
Lawrence called, trying to be severe. But after all, there was no sense in trying to keep it a secret. The news would surely be all over in a week. They would be forced to confront the gravity of their situation soon enough. Little enough harm in letting Temeraire indulge in high spirits so long as he might.
"Lawrence!"
Granby said at his shoulder.
"In the hurry! The ammunition was all laid in its usual place on the left, though we are not carrying the bombs to balance it out. We ought to restow!"
"Can you have it done before we engage?"
"Oh, good Lord!"
Lawrence said, realizing.
"I do not even know the position of the convoy, do you?"
Granby shook his head, embarrassed, and Lawrence swallowed his pride and shouted,
"Berkeley! Where are we going?"
A general explosion of mirth ran among the men on Maximus's back. Berkeley called back,
"Straight to hell! Ha ha!"
More laughter, nearly drowning out the coordinates that he bellowed over.
15 minutes flight, then,"
Lawrence was mentally running the calculation through in his head.
"And we ought to save at least 5 of those minutes for Grace."
Granby nodded.
"We can manage it,"
he said, and clambered down at once to organize the operation, unhooking and rehooking the carabiners with practiced skill from the evenly spaced rings leading down Temeraire's side to the storage nets slung beneath his belly. The rest of the formation was already in place as Temeraire and Maximus rose to take their defensive positions at the rear. Lawrence noticed the formation leader flag streaming out from Lily's back. That meant that during their absence, Captain Harcourt had at last been given the command. He was glad to see the change. It was hard on the signal ensign to have to watch a wing dragon as well as keep an eye forward, and the dragons would always instinctively follow the lead regardless of formal precedence. Still, he could not help feeling how strange that he should find himself taking orders from a 20-year-old girl. Harcourt was still a very young officer, promoted over quick due to Lily's unexpectedly early hatching. But command in the corps had to follow the capabilities of the dragons, and a rare acid spitter like one of the long wings was too valuable to place anywhere but the centre of a formation, even if they would only accept female handlers.
"Signal from the Admiral! Proceed to meeting!"
called the signal ensign, Turner. A moment later the signal, "Formation keep together!" broke out on Lily's signal yard, and the dragons were pressing on, shortly reaching their cruising speed of a steady 17 knots. An easy pace for Temeraire, but all that the Yellow Reapers and the enormous Maximus could manage comfortably for any length of time. There was time to loosen his sword in the sheath and load his pistols fresh. Below, Granby was shouting orders over the wind. He did not sound frantic, and Lawrence had every confidence in his power to get the work completed in time. The dragons of the covert made an impressive spread, even though this was not so large a force in numbers as had been assembled for the Battle of Dover in October, which had fended off Napoleon's invasion attempt. But in that battle they had been forced to send up every available dragon, even the little couriers. Most of the fighting dragons had been away south at Trafalgar. Today, Exidium and Captain Roland's formation were back in the lead, 10 dragons strong, the smallest of them a middleweight yellow reaper, and all of them flying in perfect formation, not a wing beat out of place, the skill born of many long years in formation together. Lily's formation was nothing so imposing as yet. Only 6 dragons flying behind her, with her flank and end-wing positions held by smaller and more manoeuvrable beasts with older officers, who could more easily compensate for any errors made from inexperience by Lily herself, or by Maximus and Temeraire in the back line. Even as they drew closer, Lawrence saw Sutton, the captain of their mid-wing Messoria, stand up on her back and turn to look over at them, making sure all was well with the younger dragons. Lawrence raised a hand in acknowledgement and saw Berkeley doing the same. The sails of the French convoy and the Channel fleet were visible long before the dragons came into range. There was a stately quality to the scene below, chessboard pieces moving into place, with the British ships advancing in eager haste towards the great crowd of smaller French merchantmen. A glorious spread of white sail to be seen on every ship, and the British colours streaming among them. Granby came clambering back up along the shoulder strap to Lawrence's side.
"We'll do nicely now, I think."
"Very good," Lawrence said absently, his attention all on what he could see of the British fleet peering down over Temeraire's shoulder through his glass. Mostly fast-sailing frigates, with a motley collection of smaller sloops, and a handful of 64 and 74 gunships. The Navy would not risk the largest first- and second-rate ships against the fire-breather. Too easy for one lucky attack to send a 3-decker packed full of powder up like a light, taking 6 smaller ships along with her.
"All hands to their stations, Mr. Harley," Lawrence said, straightening up, and the young ensign hurried to set the signal strap embedded in the harness to red.
The riflemen stationed along Temeraire's back let themselves partly down his sides, readying their guns, while the rest of the topmen all crouched low, pistols in their hands. Exidium and the rest of the larger formation dropped low over the British warships, taking up the more important defensive position and leaving the field to them. As Lily increased their speed, Temeraire gave a low, growling rumble, the tremor palpable through his hide. Lawrence spared a moment to lean over and put his bare hand on the side of Temeraire's neck. No words necessary, and he felt a slight easing of the nervous tension before he straightened and pulled his leather riding glove back on.
"Enemy in sight!"
came faint but audible in the shrill, high voice of Lily's forward lookout, carrying back to them on the wind, echoed a moment later by young Allen, stationed near the joint of Temeraire's wing. A general murmur went around the men, and Lawrence snapped out his glass again for a look.
"La Crabe Grande, I think,"
he said, handing the telescope over to Granby, hoping privately that he had not mangled the pronunciation too badly. He was quite sure that he had identified the formation style correctly, despite his lack of experience in aerial actions. There were few composed of 14 dragons, and the shape was highly distinct, with the 2 pincer-like rows of smaller dragons stretched out to either side of the cluster of big ones in the centre. The Flamme de Gloire was not easy to spot, with several decoy dragons of similar colouring shifting about. A pair of papillons noirs with yellow markings painted over their natural blue and green stripes to make them confusingly alike from a distance.
"Ah, I have made her! It is Alexandre! There she is, the wicked thing!"
Granby said, handing back the glass and pointing.
"She has a talon missing from her left rear leg, and she is blind in the right eye. We gave her a good dose of pepper back in the Battle of the Glorious First."
"I see her. Mr. Harley, pass the word to all the lookouts. Temeraire,"
he called, bringing up the speaking trumpet.
"Do you see the Flamme de Gloire? She is the one low and to the right, with a missing talon. She is weak in the right eye."
"I see her,"
Temeraire said eagerly, turning his head just slightly.
"Are we to attack her?"
"Our first duty is to keep her far away from the Navy's ships. Have an eye on her as best you can,"
Lawrence said, and Temeraire bobbed his head once in quick answer, straightening out again. He tucked away the glass in the small pouch hooked onto the harness. No more need for it very soon.
"You had better get below, John," Lawrence said.
I expect they will try a boarding with a few of those light fellows on their edges."
All this while they had been rapidly closing the distance. Suddenly there was no more time, and the French were wheeling about in perfect unison, not one dragon falling out of formation, graceful as a flock of birds. A low whistle came behind him. Admittedly, it was an impressive sight, but Lawrence frowned, though his own heart was speeding involuntarily.
"Belay that noise!"
One of the papillons was directly ahead of them, jaws spreading wide as if to breathe flames it could not produce. Lawrence felt an odd, detached amusement to see a dragon play-acting. Temeraire could not roar from his position in the rear, not with Massoria and Lily both in the way, but he did not duck away at all. Instead he raised his claws, and as the two formations swept together and intermingled, he and the papillon pulled up and collided with a force that jarred all of their crews loose.